Okay, we're holding on Perek Tazayin of the Netzach Yisrael. If you recall, last week we learned about in pursuing the question of how it is that Klal Yisrael suffers so profoundly in this world. If Klal Yisrael is supposed to be this great purpose of all of creation and so on and so forth, so how is it that Klal Yisrael has such suffering in this world? And he dealt with it in the previous Perek, in Perek Yud Dalid, and last week in Perek Tezvav, we spend most of the time with another part of the explanation which he provided. And that was the focus on Chelek Yaakov, that the portion of Yaakov, the portion of the Jewish people, is really Olam Haba, not Olam Hazeh. And therefore questions about the struggle and the difficulty that the Jewish people experience in this world are to some degree not to the essential point. Our purpose is in a world which is different than this one. And therefore, it should not come as a great surprise when this world is experienced as a world of tremendous challenge. That was the basic theme of his answer that we were discussing last week. And we spent a lot of the time in the case, the way he made the case, where he was speaking about the brachos of Yaakov and Esav, speaking about this basic idea, that Yaakov and Esav were merivin al nachlas shnei olamos. Their argument was about the two worlds, who would have which one, and demonstrating insight from within the parsha. What he's going to do in this section is continue the discussion of Yaakov and Esav, continue this discussion of the division between the two of them, the division of portions, the division of opportunities. However, he's going to do it using a classic agarita, and it's going to be really taking the form of analyzing this agarita and analyzing outward and backward to the source in Yaakov and Esav. The agarita which he is analyzing is something which is in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Aleph Amud Beis, where the Gemara says as follows: Amar Rav Yudah Mar Shmuel, Oida Cheres Yesh Lam Beraimi. There was another practice that they had in Rome. Achas l'shivim shana, once every 70 years, mevi'in adam shalem u'markivin ha'isei al adam chiger. They bring a man who is whole, a man who is a fine physical specimen, and markivin ha'isei, and they have him ride al adam chiger. On top of, they have him sit on the shoulders of an adam chiger, a person who is lame. U'malbishin ha'isei bigli adam arishay, and they dress him in quote unquote the garments of adam arishay. And they put on his face the mask of Rabbi Shmuel. Some of you may remember the agadita about the Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol was one of the Harugei Malchus. He was one of the 10 martyrs. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol was the second one to be killed. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Shmuel were the first two, and they drew lots, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel won. So he was killed first, and he would not have to see the death of Rabbi Shmuel. When Rabbi Shmuel Amiel died, so Rabbi Shmuel was crying over him. He put his eyes on his eyes and his mouth on his mouth, and so on and so forth. And meanwhile, the daughter of the case, Harsar Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. And Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol was beautiful. He was just a wonderfully, wonderfully, breathtakingly handsome, beautiful person. And she pleaded with her father that he should spare him. Why? Because she was interested in his beauty. She was interested in him physically. And he refused. He refused this entreaty of his daughter. And so she said, well, at least maybe you can save his beauty. And so this young woman recommended, and the Caesar was happy to accommodate, that they would skin Rabbi Shmuel alive. That was the way they killed him. They skinned him. Right? That way they would be able to do some kind of a taxidermy or whatever it was, so you'd be able to have a mask of the beauty of Rabbi Shmuel, of the image of the face of Rabbi Shmuel, that would be intact even after his death. I guess it wasn't this kind of thing that they would just, chop off the head and, preserve it, and you'd be able to see the beauty of Rabbi Shmuel. They had to do something more torturous, more effective, whatever it was. But as Rashi brings here, as you find to some degree in the Gemara where it describes it, they skinned his face and chanta b'aparsamayin, and it was embalmed in a farsamayin and balsam oil, so that it would last, and it remained stored in the Roman treasuries. This mask of Rabbi Shmuel, and they would take it out for this ceremony once every 70 years, and they would put it on this Adam Shalem, this man who stood on top of the other one. V'tolu le b'tzavore miskal dalet zuzi to Pisa, and they would hang around his neck the weight of, some say 200 zuz, some say raise zuzi to Pisa, only 4 zuz of gold. U'mechapines hashvachim v'inach, and they also would pave the streets with inach, with whatever it is, onyx or whatever it is, some kind of a precious thing. And umachrizin lefanav, and they would announce in front of him, sach kirei plaster, the cheshbain of the end of days, it's all false. It's all false. The Jewish people will not prevail. Achua de Marana, the brother of our master, of our Zayda, Zayfana, he's a liar. In other words, this was, here you have the explicit mention, this was Rome. Rome are the descendants of Esav HaRasha. And as the descendants of Esav HaRasha, they are constantly concerned about Yaakov Avinu and the descendants of Yaakov Avinu, about the Jewish people. And this ceremony, which took place once every 70 years, was to try to demonstrate the continuing strength of Esav over Yaakov, and their belief, or at least their desire to believe, that they were sitting pretty and they would be secure in triumphing over Yaakov for the long term. So all of the elements that are described here are part and parcel of expanding on this metaphor, and we're going to deal with it piece by piece. Right, the most simple one is that Yaakov Avinu was the Adam Chiger. He was the lame one. Why? Because remember, in the encounter of Yaakov with the angel of Esav, he came away tzolea al yirecho. He came away limping. And that was the part, even though Yaakov was healed by the time he got to the city of Shechem, by Yavo Yaakov Sholem Yir Shechem, but however, they're harping on that piece. And so, you know, this is all going to be metaphorical, and all the other elements, as we'll see as well. And therefore, when Esav, representing the Adam Sholem, the whole one, is on the shoulders of Yaakov, represented by the limping one, is the period which they are experiencing, and which they want to perpetuate, which is Esav over Yaakov. Esav on top of Yaakov. And so they said that this Geula, this promised redemption that the Jews are supposed to have, bah, it's nothing. We're going to triumph forever. And the brother of our master, the brother of Esav, he's a liar. In other words, he stole and cheated his way to get the brachos, that he should triumph over his brother Esav, and therefore, it's not going to get him any place. He's not going to ultimately have it. Says the Gemara, the one who gets to see it, sees, loichami, loichami. And whoever doesn't get to see it, doesn't get to see it, right? Which, the way Rashi says, a person who got to see it now, great. A person who didn't get to see it now, forget about it. Because it's going to be another 70 years till they did it again. They did it only once in 70 years. And therefore, this was basically what we would call a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If they didn't make it now, then it wasn't like the Olympics that they'd be able to try again in 4 years. Says the Gemara, and then he said, Mayahani l'ramo b'rama usay, ulezayfana b'zayfan usay. What did it help the tricker his trickery, and the forger his forgeries? Right, umesam in b'hachib, right? In other words, it didn't help Yaakov to try to trick his way to the blessings, you see? But then they said, and they ended with the following, echoes of the wife of Haman. Vailadain kadyokum dain. Woe to this one when this other one will arise. Esav is laughing now, and they are insecurely sort of protesting that the same is going to be true for them for the future. But woe unto Esav when Yaakov will actually arise and come in strength again. That's the Gemara. That's the ceremony. The Gemara brings it in the context of all kinds of days of celebration that were there amongst the Goyim, that are listed in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah as days when we have to be careful in terms of our own behaviors. Okay, so that's the ceremony of the descendants of Esav. And again, in light of what we learned about in the Maharal last week, where he spoke about Yaakov and Esav basically dividing this world and the next world, this ceremony, this Agadita, which describes a ceremony, which is so laden with symbolism, becomes a very valuable text for the Maharal in order to be able to explore the differences between Yaakov and Esav. And that's really what he's doing. And that's really what he's doing here. Now, let's start from the end, if you will. We know that, and we talked about it a little bit last week, that there's an idea in the conclusion of our discussion. There's an idea which exists necessarily between Yaakov and Esav, which is the idea of the inverse relationship. La'aym mila'aym ye'amatz. As Rivka experienced the pains of these two children fighting within her, and she went to the for it to be deciphered, and it was told, you know, one kingdom gets strength from the other. Yaakov and Esav, right, the Gemara expresses it in this way. If somebody will tell you that Rome and Yerushalayim are both strong, don't believe them. Rome representing Malchus, Romi representing Esav, and Yerushalayim, it can't be. They don't both have strength simultaneously. They have this inverse relationship. When one is strong, the other is weak. And therefore, Tzur was only built from the destruction of Yerushalayim, and vice versa. It can't be that both will simultaneously exist. And if that's the case, they're not going to have a good relationship. They're not going to have a good relationship. The only way people have a good relationship is if they're going to be secure that that person's not going to get in their way. Right? The Gemara always counsels us to recognize with each other and not to be upset with each other, because in Adam Nageya b'muchan l'chaveray. What you have is not going to make any difference to me. I'm not going to be any better off if you have less, if you have more. You're not going to take what's mine. You don't affect me. Right? Like Yosef's attitude was towards his own brothers. When it comes to Yaakov and Esav, indeed, there is this inverse relationship. And therefore, Yaakov and Esav will always be struggling, because one can only be strong when the other one is weak. And therefore, Esav is preoccupied with being triumphing over Yaakov Avinu. If Yaakov is strong, he is gone. He is curtains. And therefore, he is relishing the time which he is on top. He is celebrating, again, with it's filled with insecurity, the celebration. And as he says at the end, after all the bombast of, you know, here we're on top, and Yaakov is a cheater and a liar, and see, it didn't help him one bit. But, ayvei, woe to this one when that one arises. Like we have ourselves, right, as we mentioned in Megillas Esther, by Haman and Zeresh, right? One night, right? Zeresh is telling Haman, go make a tree that's tall and you'll hang up Mordechai and so on, go to the king and you'll tell him that we'll hang up Mordechai. And the next night, after Balailahu Nadadashna, the next day after Balailahu Nadadashna Samelach, after the king's sleep was disturbed, and you see Mordechai starting to rise, that he is being paraded through the streets by Haman. So what happens? So Zeresh's whole tune changes. And she says, Imizera HaYehudim Mordechai Asher HaChilois HaLin Palofanav LeSuchalai. You started to fall before him. It looks like things are going in the other direction. Forget about it. You will not be able to overcome him. Vai L'dein Kadyokum Dein. Woe unto this one when this one starts to arise. It's a remarkable change of her tune. Right? It's a tremendous transition that happens in Zeresh, literally overnight. But the thing is, that's Esav. When he's on top, he's going to be full of bombast, full of confidence. But he knows that when things start to turn, it's going to be a big issue. So this is a very, very big part of the tension. But now let's look at more of the detail of where we see this issue between Yaakov and Esav and how it comes across in this thing. Now, the once in 70 years, the idea is, is something which requires explanation. Why did they do it this way? Why did they do it in this format? You know, one approach which the Maral does not take is that, remember, this is the next Golus, the next destruction, second destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The first destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was at the hands of Bavel, then handed over to Madayan Paras. And how long did that last? 70 years. So therefore, every 70 years, they would say, look, we still got them. And we know, the Gemara tells us, how the difference is between the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash and the second one, that the first one only lasted 70 years, but the second one, right, we're up to a couple of thousand and counting, right? Almost up to a couple of thousand. We're still waiting. We are still waiting. So you can understand to some degree why every 70 years, as they once again, you know, another time over, surpass the previous bringing down of the Jews, they celebrate once again. The Maral says something which fits the sort of like the closing note of the Gemara a lot more elegantly. You know, he adds to it, and he says the idea is, because this is not an individual matter, this is a matter of the Klal called Esav versus the Klal called Yaakov, the family of Esav, the group of Esav versus the group of Yaakov, the corporate entity of Esav versus the corporate entity of Yaakov. And that's why they did this once every 70 years, because every 70 years is a dar, is a generation. And a generation is, that's the entity, right? So each generation, they indeed did it once. And that implies against the Kolius. So they say to the individual, you know, look, if you didn't make it, you're not going to have another chance to see it. This is not for the individual. This is for the generation. Whoever got to see it as part of the Kol, as part of the corporate entity, gets to see it again. The Maral doesn't go into this, but I think it's just worthy of note before we go on to look at the details of the story. But there's a facet here which is very fascinating. Milcham el Hashem Amalek midar dar. The war of Hashem is against Amalek from generation to generation. It doesn't say from generation to generation. It doesn't say generation and generation. It says midar dar. Right? It says generation, generation. Which implies each one separately. Which to some degree would be borne out by this Gemara. And one can say, and this is something which is discussed in that context, that this is one of the features of Esav, is that Esav doesn't have a heritage. The difference between Yaakov and Esav was that Yaakov has this, you know, continuity of Bris Aves Labanim Tiskar. So each generation is not so distinct from the one before it. Our whole idea is bridging the generations. By Esav, each generation stands alone. Each generation has its own commemoration of this event. But we're not going to go into that at length. That's sort of an addition to consider as you look at this Gemara.
Esav, you're saying, is not basically the spiritual successors, because you don't have the physical ones. I
mean, what do you mean?
Germany, you could say, was Amalek or whatever, but how do we know that all of the Christian world and the Western world today is overall viewed as Esav?
So this is
not like us, where we know that they're Jewish.
Right. So this was the famous thing that is said over in the name of Reb Chaim. This is the Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim Brisker says that when you look at the Rambam, and it speaks about the mitzvah of destroying the seven nations of Canaan, so then he says there was a mitzvah to destroy the seven nations of Canaan, but we don't know who they are anymore. When it comes to the mitzvah of destroying Amalek, he doesn't say we don't know who they are anymore. He doesn't say it. So they say in the name of Reb Chaim, that Reb Chaim said that Amalek can be easily defined by the nation that stands up to destroy the Jewish people. That's Amalek. And whether it is biological or otherwise, it all is nursed and nurtured by the Koyach, by the power of Amalek. Now Amalek came from Esav. Amalek wasn't all of Esav. In fact, Amalek was to some degree the least. Amalek was the child of a Pilegesh, the child of a concubine of Esav. That's why he doesn't have the same strength in a certain sense to remain in the world that Esav on some level has. However, you know, our view of it generally is that Esav became Edom. Edom became Rome. That's the way Chazal viewed it. And the Rome became although originally it was very much, of course, as you know, opposed to Christianity, it became the seat of Christianity, and the kingdom of Rome that continues to some degree control the world is the Vatican, is the Catholic Church, right? While it does not control the world so perfectly, right now it's struggling with its father-in-law, right? Yishmael, right? With the Muslims, right? So there's that. But that we view ourselves as still being in the Malchus Haraviyas. So we view it like that. And whether you're going to say because they stand up against the Jewish people, or whether you're going to say because they're literally the heirs to it. But that's the way we view this, as a continuation of Esav, if not of Amalek. The Gemara continues. So the once every 70 years, what do? They brought an Adam Sholem, and they put him on top of an Adam Chigir. And as we said, this is going to be, as Rashi says, Adam Sholem is Keneged Esav, Adam Chigir is Keneged Yaakov. The whole one, the perfect physical specimen, corresponds to Esav. The imperfect hobbling specimen corresponds to Yaakov. So Leal Yerecho, who was hobbling on his thigh. And the symbolism was, Rashi says, Adayin Esav Shelot al Yaakov. Esav is still on top of Yaakov. This was the symbolism of one being on top of the other. Now here we start to get to some basic fundamental definition, very much resonant of what we talked about last time, which is that Esav is this full, complete, perfect physical specimen, and Yaakov is not. Esav is complete. That's his name, right? Esav was called Esav because he was born hairy, right? So, you know, I always think that, you know, if we would take a survey of people, they would say, oh, that's simple, because Esav is grass, right? But Esav is grass with a vase, right? Right? So it's not that he's sprouted things. Esav is from the term osui, which means complete. He was born already developed, already, you know, developed in certain ways physically that would be unexpected. But that's what Esav represents. Esav represents full, proper physical development. Yaakov Avinu, to some degree, was never properly developed. Yaakov continued to be an ish chalak. He was smooth. He never grew the usual hair that would be typical of a developed man. And Yaakov Avinu, this also came across in this notion of Yaakov Avinu being hobbled by the malach, by the angel of Esav in that battle. This is Esav's physical completeness versus Yaakov Avinu's lack of completeness in the physical realm. In Olam Hazeh, in the physical world, they are different. And the choice of the Yerech, the choice of the thigh, is the thigh, the leg, being specifically representative of the physical. Of the physical. It's a reality. First of all, that area of the Yerech, when we talk, for instance, about the first two mitzvahs in the Torah, following the mitzvah of Pru Urvu, of be fruitful and multiply, are the mitzvah of Bris Mila, which takes place on the inside of the thigh, right? The Pasuk says, when they made the covenant, remember, place your hand beneath my thigh, which was a way of saying the Bris Mila, right? That was the way they took the Bris, that's why they took their own oath. And then you have the next mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of Gid Anosha, which is, you know, the sciatic vein, or whatever it is, that area of the thigh from that story of Yaakov with the angel, that they wouldn't eat it anymore, the Bnei Israel wouldn't eat it anymore. That's from the outside of the thigh. Right? The thigh, so in a sense, this way I like to structure it, is that the three mitzvahs of Sefer Bereishis are all around the thigh. Puruvu is be fruitful and multiply, right, is from that area. And then we have the refinement of the Bris Mila, as opposed to the negative of the Gid Hanasha, within that area. It's, you know, that very mitzvah of Puruvu sort of hits that fork in the road between Bris Mila, which we do, and the Gid Hanasha that we avoid. And it's this issue of physicality, which, yeah, in the mitzvah of Bris Mila, we go and we turn it into a positive thing. We turn it into something that's going to be whole. It's not a. It's an interesting thing, not a coincidence, that right from Yaakov Avinu becoming healed, from the limp of the Gid Hanasha, he goes on to Shechem, where he has the problem with Dinah, and they bring a bris mila to all of the inhabitants of Shechem. I mean, excuse me if I'm giving you too many little tidbits, but you see there's a stream here. There's a stream here of related events, you know, that come to it. But the thigh, in the greatest sense, represents the physicality, right? The loins, right? That area represents, in many, many ways, the chaimer, the physicality of the person. The regel, the leg of a person, is what has the person on the ground. It's the point of connection of the person to earthiness, to the physicality. We even refer to the physical world. What did you say? What do you say in the davening, right? This morning, the earth is described as the footstool of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? The physical manifestation, so to speak, that's down here in this world. The footstool of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There's a level beyond, but yes, go ahead.
It's kind of fits in that you say, when they said Yaakov is used to the Akeh, basically that's his job, is to bring the spiritual down to the lowest point of the physical.
His job is to do it, and the question is, how successful, at least in the interim, he's going to do. Yes, that's his task, and that's a task which he, in saying, I'll take Olam Haba and you take Olam Hazeh, on some level he is, you know, he's passing on. And that's what a large part of what we were talking about last week. Yaakov's natural perfection is not in the this worldly realm, as we will see some more.
What is the word shoket then fit into that? Low shoket ha'ish, he doesn't want the what do they call the shoket, the thigh, the lower part of the...
What verse are you quoting?
In the Haluka, in Sukkot Zimra.
Yeah. Le'bigvuras hasus yechbatz, le'bishayka yish yirtzeh. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not interested in the shaykh of, in the strength of the horse, or in the thigh, or the leg. The shaykh is actually separate from the yarech, but also the leg of man.
The shaykh is what, the lower part of it?
According to most Rishayim, it's used, the consensus is that it's used in different ways in different places. It's in fact the basis for a basic debate in Hilchas Tznius between the Chazanish and many others. Because the Gemara says, shaykh bi'isha erva. The shoke of a woman is considered a private place. So does that mean the upper leg, which is why, or does it mean even the lower leg? The Chazanish held it meant even the lower leg. That's why the Chazanish held in min hadin, not mitam minag, but min hadin, a woman has to wear stockings. So to that even the lower leg should be covered. Yeah.
The Bnei Esav are making a big deal that he's a chigger, that they won because the Malach injured Yaakov, but actually Yaakov pinned him. He begged to be released.
Right.
So we won.
Okay.
How do they reconcile that?
Okay. So we're gonna see a little bit more. We're gonna see a little bit more about that. Let's just take another couple of minutes to just talk about this shaykh issue. There's another aspect that makes the shaykh representative of the physical in the Maral, and this is a little bit of the depth of the Maral, which really we have to see as a contrast to the next piece, and that is that they dressed him in the garments of Adam Arisha, and they placed on his head the mask of Rabbi Shmuel. The garments of Adam Arishain, as we know, were taken by Esav. Bigdei Esav benoach amudais, asher ita baboyis. When Rivka dressed Yaakov Avinu as part of his disguise, that he would be Esav, she dressed him in Esav's favorite clothes that she kept in her house. He trusted Rivka to keep them from her. He didn't trust his wives. The garments of Adam Arishain were the garments of Esav. He had inherited them from Nimrod, or he had Chamad Esav Nimrod, he had stolen them from Nimrod. That was Esav's chelek. Now, there's a very interesting thing that the Gemara says, that the shufra, that the beauty of the face of Yaakov Avinu was like the beauty, it just says shufra, I shouldn't say the beauty of the face, but it's understood by everybody to mean the face, of Yaakov Avinu was like the beauty of Adam Arishain. Chazal tell us, different places, famously, that the image of Adam that's on Hashem's Merkava, so to speak, on Hashem's chariot, is the image of Yaakov Avinu. Right? When the Malachim saw the face of Yaakov Avinu, they recognized him. It was like the face of Adam Arishain. So if you think about it, here you have Yaakov and Esav, twins, and they both, in a certain sense, inherit from Adam Arishain. One inherits his face, and one inherits his wardrobe. And when you think about it further, you recognize that Adam Arishon, as he was created, right, his face, his being, that was the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu created him. Yitzir Kapav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the original formation of Hashem's, so to speak, hands. Whereas the clothing that Adam Arishon had to wear was a result of the chet, result of the sin. When he sinned and he introduced into himself a special power, a corruptive power of physicality, then Hashem made for him cloaks of skin, leather, whatever it was. Whatever clothes Adam Arishon wore, those clothes were necessitated by chet. And so in a sense, you look at it and you say, here you have it. He has two things that he's going to bequeath to his children. Is that the right word? Right, two that he's going to give over to his children. One of them is from the good old days, and one of them is from the days when already the corruption and the sullying of the chet is in the world. And Yaakov Avinu says, I'll take the face. I'll take Adam Arishon Kaidem Achet. Which, as I've told you before, the Gemara says explicitly in Masechah Shabbos that Adam Arishon's sin did bring corruption into the human beings that maintained itself to some degree in Avram, to some degree in Yitzchak, until Yaakov. By Yaakov it was cleansed. Yaakov Avinu was indeed like Adam Arishon, Kadam Achet. Yaakov Avinu, on some level, we say Yaakov Avinu didn't die. Right? The sin brought death, mortality in the world. On some level, Yaakov Avinu indeed didn't die. He was a throwback, right, to Adam Arishon, Kadam Achet. And so he had the face, the original face of Adam Arishon. Whereas Esav, he grabbed on to the world as it was corrupted. He took the clothing of Adam Arishain. That's what he took. And that was the part of the story that Esav celebrated, that Esav wanted to grab onto. Similarly, we find, you know, with Cain and Hevel, who are also portrayed as coming into the world after the sin, or at least developing in the world after the sin, where Cain, who quote-unquote is the bad guy, he goes and he becomes a farmer. The land was cursed and corrupted by the sin. Arura ha'adama, the earth is cursed because of what you've done. So he said, okay, fine, great. I like this earth post-sin. I like this earth where Hashem isn't roving around over here like he was in Gan Eden. Right? Hashem maybe doesn't know what's going on down here. That's why he says to me, you know, where's your brother? Right? Cain liked the world post-sin. Hevel? Oh my gosh, the world that was corrupted by sin? I don't want that. I want the world which is still perfect. So what did he become? He became a shepherd. Right? Shepherd, you know, you're still dealing with animals that realize that human beings are on top of them. Right? He wanted to stay in the world that was unsullied by sin. Very similar to Yaakov and Esav. Yaakov was a shepherd, and Esav was a farmer. Yaakov grabbed onto the face of Adam Arishon as it was before the sin, while Esav took the clothing of Adam Arishon that was there after the alteration, after the damage, which was done by sin. And when we speak about the face of Adam Arishon, we can look at the face of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol had this unparalleled beauty on his face, and they wanted to have that. The daughter of the Caesar, she saw something magnificent and special and beautiful there in the face of Adam Arishon and in the face of Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol. And indeed, on Yom Kippur, when we say the piyut of Yom Kippur, of the avodah of Yom Kippur, we speak about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the whole world, and for that he made Adam Arishain. You know, it was the climax. The whole world was for Adam Arishain. And we go in through this whole piyut till we get to the Kohen Gadol going into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and Yom HaKippurim. And what do we say afterwards? Right? Because that's what it's all about. Well, it wasn't for a once a year event. No. It was meant for man to be in Gan Eden, to be in the presence of Hashem constantly. What we have of that is, left of that is, the Kohen Gadol going in to the Kodesh HaKadoshim and Yom HaKippurim. That's as close as we get. That's the once a year one person, one being goes in to do what Adam HaRishon was created to be. And what did we say? Remember Yom Kippur Musaf? After we describe the Kohen Gadol going in, Mare Kohen. We say, oh, when the Kohen Gadol came out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, you know what he looked like? He looked like a rainbow in the clouds. He looked like a chasan. He looked like the sun, right? It was the magnificent shine that was on his face. Adam v'yikar v'lo yolin nimshal kadehemais nidmu. Right, the pasuk says in Tehillim. Adam was created with yakar, with glory, with a magnificent, magnificent appearance. But he didn't even hold it overnight. It didn't even stay with him overnight. He lost it on the first day with the sin. And the Rabbi Shmuel, who was the Kohen Gadol, who went back lifnai v'lifnim, Rabbi Shmuel had the beauty of Adam HaRishon. Me'ein, the beauty of Adam HaRishon. Mare Kohen, that's what that is. It's restoring to man his original glory, the beauty of his face. So now, let's go back. So now we've had three pieces. We've had the wholeness of Esau versus the limping of Yaakov. We've had the clothing of Adam HaRishon versus the face of Adam HaRishon. The mask of Rabbi Shmuel representing the face of Adam HaRishon. So on the one hand, Esau has the clothing, which we understand, and he has the thigh strength versus Yaakov having the facial strength. So here, let me just point out the Maharal's very, very important, deep, and subtle explanation. The face is exposed. Generally speaking, you know, a person might cover up everything else, but you got to keep your face uncovered, unless you're a lady in Afghanistan, right? You know, basically, you got to, you know, that's what you're going to have to, that's what you have to do. A person walks around, right? The panim, right? The face is the face by which a person is seen, by which a person is recognized.
Is that why they do it?
I don't know. I have a feeling there's some more simple reasons. But the yarech, the thigh, is the fundamental thing which is hidden. Even Adam, right, before Hashem was walking back around in the garden, what did they do? You know, they covered their midsection. They covered the thigh. They covered that area. The Gemara speaks, right, in Shir Hashirim, Chamuki Yerechech, your thigh is hidden. Right? The Gemara uses it as a paradigm for that which is hidden. It says the Torah is compared to the Yarech. In a certain sense, it's not supposed to be always out in the open like that. You have to do it more subtly, right? No billboards, right? Talmidim Rabbi Rosenberg will appreciate. I think he used to be very much focusing on that Gemara, right? The thigh is hidden, and the face is open. The thigh is hidden, it's in the dark. And the face is described as bright and as luminous. And he said, and the way the Maharal explains it is like this. Chaymer and Surah. Remember how many times we've discussed this dichotomy that's so central to everything? Right, the physical by itself is just a material, it's the ball of Play-Doh. The Tzura is the shape, is the form, is the purpose, is the direction, that which makes it unique, identifiable, you know, formed to a certain shape, to a certain direction. And in the greatest sense, Esav is driven and dragged down by Chaymer, and Yaakov is sublime, is Tzura. Remember, we learned about it last time. That's why when Esav is destroyed, he's never really destroyed, because there's the law of preservation of matter. Right, the gob of Play-Doh is still the gob of Play-Doh, whether it's shaped like a flower, whether it's shaped like a car, or whether it's just a mass of a ball. But on the other hand, if your whole thing is the subtlety of the shape, the flower, all you do is mush it a little bit, and there's no more flower. Right, the delicacy of Klal Yisrael is so much more subject to utter destruction. There's no law of the preservation of form. There is a law of the preservation of matter. Tzura, form, is visible and is bright. Chaimer, plain matter, is just bleh. It's just dark. And it doesn't provide the luminescence. It doesn't provide the direction. It doesn't provide the fetching image. Yaakov is on the face. Esav is on the yerech. And Yaakov in the physicality, in that realm, weak, vulnerable. Esav, indeed, much, much stronger. So this picture is a picture of the relative strengths of Yaakov versus Esav. Yaakov's strength of Tzura, of the face, of the world of before the sin. Esav's strength of the leg, the physical connection to the earth, the chaimer, the matter. But you know, the fellow on top at this point in time was the physical one. And yes, he wanted to grab the beautiful face of Rabbi Yishmael. Because the beautiful face of Rabbi Yishmael is that point where the spiritual indeed takes the physical and makes it into something. Remember our discussion, I think we got up to this last week, excuse me if we did not. Right? But there is this idea of the extent to which the physical is able to be overtaken by the spiritual, which will be seen in something like the radiance of the face of Moshe Rabbeinu, the beauty of the face of Yaakov Avinu, the beauty of the face of Adam HaRishon, the Pnim, right? The face is the point of intersection between the body and the soul. The wisdom of a person that's inside Torah Panav will illuminate his face. That's what we're trying to get to. That's what we're trying to achieve, to have. And so Yaakov Avinu, so Esav HaRasha, he knows that the face of Rabbi Shmuel, the face of Adam, the face of Yaakov, I mean, it's beautiful, it's magnificent. It's more magnificent than anything he could be, because the beauty of the face is indeed going to be nurtured and developed by something deep inside. Panim Pnim, first surface, the face is Pnim, is going to be from the inside. He doesn't have the good inside, but he likes the way it shows itself in its specific perfection on the outside, and he wants to co-opt it. He wants to co-opt it. He wants to have that physical beauty, so to speak, that's only going to be a result of that. Something which he couldn't have by itself. The daughter of the Caesar recognizes that there's something that transforms physical beauty. It's not just the beauty of a thigh, but the beauty of a bright, beautiful face. Right? The beauty of a face is still, to this day, will be the beauty of an innocent face, of a bright of that. Esav recognizes it.
Are we supposed to correlate the spirituality with the neshama and the thigh with the goof? I mean, is that something that we're getting at?
Yeah, very much. Very much. Very much so. Very much so. And Yaakov is not strong as the goof. Yaakov is strong as the neshama. And Yaakov's was forced. And here we go to this later stage of the Gemara. Right, excuse me, Ramar also speaks about these other things, right? So he has the gems hanging around his neck and he paves the streets. You know, all of these things which are superficial and external. Right? Esav surrounds himself with all of the trappings of greatness and magnificence, but internally schwach, internally lacking and wanting. And he says, Sach kirei plaster. It ain't happening. The Jewish people are not going to be redeemed. Esav wants to reassure himself of the falsehood of redemption. Because the brother of our master, he was a liar. What did it help him? What did it help him to cheat and to try to get his way to the brachas? You see, we're winning. In this physical world, we are winning. And they are winning. They were winning. And in a great sense, they are winning. And this is the piece which we're missing. We're missing the strength, the spiritual strength of Klal Yisrael in the physical world. I spoke about this at length yesterday in the Pirkei Avos Shir / this Shir about Eretz Yisrael, about this being a very, very fundamental part of what we're looking for. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us a land where we sink our hands and our fingernails into the earth, Right? Mitzvah Satlius Baretz, the claim of Eretz Yisrael, is only when we become farmers, when we engage with the cursed land, and we turn it into a mitzvah. That's what we're looking for. Because otherwise, we're left with, as we discussed last week, we're left with this stalemate. Where Yaakov has Elam Haba, but this world remains a world controlled by Esav, a world of contradictions, a world of falsehood, a world of Chilul Hashem. And we're not satisfied with that. We want a world which will manifest Hashem's presence. We want to take on the curse head on. We want Yaakov to be strong in this world. And here we get for a few minutes to what you raised before, Michael, which was about the... One second, didn't Yaakov win that fight? Didn't Yaakov win that fight with the angel? Didn't the angel have to ask him permission to leave? But that Parshas Vayishlach, and again, we don't have time to discuss this at length, but, you know, snapshots, the Parsha of Yaakov and Esav is, you know, in a certain sense, kol haTorah kula. Yaakov, in Parshas Vayishlach, has two encounters. One encounter is with Esav, and the other encounter is with the angel of Esav. They happen one after the other. First with the angel of Esav, then with Esav. And they are two opposite, inverse encounters. In the encounter with the angel of Esav, who wins? Yaakov. Yaakov Avinu says, the angel says, okay, let me go. And Yaakov Avinu says, I'm not letting you go until Berachtoni, until you give me a blessing. Right? And he has to give him a blessing. And the blessing which he gives him is that his name is not going to be Yaakov, but his name is going to be Yisrael. Yaakov implies lowly, having to trick, you know, being on the bottom of things in this world, waiting for the end of days. Yisrael means Tsar, Yashar, strong. You're going to be strong, you're going to be upright. Right? There, Yaakov Avinu wins. When Yaakov Avinu goes to meet Esav, what does he do? He's bowing, tripping over himself. You're my master. Instead of the Malach of Esav giving a gift to Esav, to Yaakov, a gift of a bracha, Yaakov Avinu tells Esav, take my bracha. That's where he refers to the gift. Kachno es birchasi asher huvaslach. Take it from me. He gives it to him. And it's an opposite encounter. And indeed, there, Esav says, oh, come, we're going to go together. He doesn't want to leave Yaakov alone. And Yaakov has to weasel his way out, and he says, you know, I can't keep up with you, and so on and so forth. So he manages to escape, quote unquote, the polite clutches of Esav. The polite but firm clutches of Esav. The two stories are exact opposites of each other. They're mamish the reverse of each other. Look at it closely, you'll see. They're mamish the reverse of each other. When Yaakov has a mystical, otherworldly encounter with the angel of Esav, that's Yaakov in the Olam Haba. And Yaakov in the Olam Haba, he wins. But when Yaakov has a this worldly encounter with the physical Esav, that's Olam Hazeh. And in Olam Hazeh, Yaakov Avinu finds himself deferring to Esav and saying, Esav, you win. You're the master. Right now, in the here and now, you're the master. You win. You are ahead of the game.
Doesn't make sense. Because if you defeat the Tsar, what goes happens down here devolves from above. So the Tsar loses. Whoever it is, Yaakov or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then we overcome it.
It should normally be that way. This world would be a manifestation of the higher worlds. But it didn't happen that way. At least, in a certain sense, in the immediate sense, it didn't happen that way. It would eventually happen. It would eventually happen, but it didn't immediately happen. I always like to point out this, that if you look at the Pasuk, the Malach says, Hisarisa im Elokim, I'm calling you Yisrael, because Sarisa im Elokim v'im Anoshim v'tucha. Because you struggled for supremacy with Elohim or Elohim, with God or with the angel, whichever you translate it, with Vim Anoshim and with man, Vatuchal, and you prevailed. So I have two questions. First question is, was it with Anoshim, was it with man? You'll say, yeah, it was, because it was an angel, it was an Elohim, it was appearing as a man. It says, he encountered a man. But Chazal tells it was really an angel. And later it says he called his name Peniel because he saw Elohim, Panim El Panim. So I understand, is he a god or is he a man? So you say, okay, it's both, right? But I have a second question. He shouldn't have been called Yisrael. He should have been called Yisroelansh. Why? Because he says, I'm calling you Yisrael because Sarisa im el Aikim, right? Yisrael the imanoshim, and with man. Where's the hint in the name to Anoshim? It just says Yisrael. His name should have been Yisrael Lunch. But everybody would think we were out to lunch. Right? Well, like, what's the... Well, huh? They still think we're out to lunch. Right? So where is that? So the prevailing over Elohim takes hold a lot quicker than the prevailing over Anoshim. He's still bowing down to Esav. He's still bowing down to the human one. In this world, he's still subordinate. Even after he took the brachos, in the beginning of Vayishlach, before he meets Esav, the telegram he sends to Esav says, look, my father promised me dew of the heavens, fat of the land. That bracha that I stole, he promised dew of the heavens, fat of the land. I have no agricultural success. All my success is in livestock. I'm the same old shepherd, right, that Zadie was. In Lavan Garti, he promised me that I would be a prince, that nations would bow down to me. I've been living as a stranger, as a guest, in a foreign land for all these teams. I'm not a prince. And Esav, he said, my brothers are going to bow down to me. I'm calling you my master. I'm saying I'm your servant. None of that really happened. This line of Esav, Mayahani leil ramo b'ramu usei, what did it help Esav Yaakov to trick his way into the brachos, is a line out of Yaakov Avinu's script. That's what Yaakov Avinu was saying to Esav. It didn't help me any. That's during the time when he bows down to Esav. It doesn't help me any. It doesn't help me any. And what the Maharal is Maisif. Right? Now, of course, in the end, he knows, Esav says, Vayiladein kad yokum dein. There will be a time when it will be fulfilled. And then poor Esav. Boy, is he going to be finished. Maybe he thinks it's going to be an Olam Haba, or maybe he knows that there's going to be a time in this world where the world will become Yaakov's world, and then Esav will go to the dustbin of history. Will certainly be humbled and lowered before Yaakov. But says the Maharal, Mayahani l'ramo b'ramo usei, it's obvious that the fact that during so much of this world Yaakov is humbled before Esav is because the only way he got the brachos was with Ramos, was that straightforward. We struggle. How could those brachos even have worked? What kind of a thing is it? In a certain sense, it's only because of the Ramos. It's only because it wasn't a direct, open confrontation. So therefore, to a certain degree, Esav still held on to something. And Yitzchak was able to tell Esav, you know, you also have the dew of the heavens, you also have the fat of the land. And when Yaakov falls, so you're going to be strong. But had it been more clear, more absolute, had Yaakov been able to take the entirety of the physical world, not just the shining face, but the thigh, every bit of it, would be a different story. It would be a different story. Esav is right to celebrate while the party is still going. Vayiladein kad yokum dein. But he's had a long party.
Yeah.
He's going to be really hungover when this is finished.
Okay. Don't eat that.